From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, making Johnny Carson laugh, we talk with comic David Steinberg. Back in the 60s and 70s, he appeared on The Tonight Show over 100 times. And he lunched with such comedy giants as Jack Benny, George Burns, and Groucho Marx. He's written a new memoir about his life in the business. It's called The Book of David. Also, saxophonist Harry Allen and singer Eddie Erickson. They've collaborated on a new jazz CD of songs from Guys and Dolls. We'll talk with them and hear some of those tunes. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our first guest today, David Steinberg, discovered improv comedy as a very young man and has been living off it and working in it ever since. In the 1960s, he became famous for his improvised comic sermons about the Bible, one of which was partly responsible for CBS yanking the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour off the air. Steinberg continued to release hit comedy recordings of his stand-up act, but in the past 20 years, David Steinberg has done most of his work behind the camera, as a director, usually working with other like-minded, quick-thinking comics. His directorial credits read like a who's who of cutting-edge TV comedy. They include working with Gary Shandling on It's Gary Shandling Show, Paul Reiser on Mad About You, Bob Newhart on Newhart, Jerry Seinfeld on Seinfeld, and Larry David on Curb Your Enthusiasm. In the 1960s and 70s, David Steinberg was one of Johnny Carson's most frequent guests and earliest guest hosts on The Tonight Show. Decades later, he's still a TV host, interviewing other comedians on TV Land's sit-down comedy with David Steinberg. He also recently published a memoir, his first, titled The Book of David. David Steinberg, welcome to Fresh Air.
Oh, thank you, Dave. It's a pleasure to be here.
I want to start the interview with you by playing a portion of you interviewing somebody else. It's from Sit Down Comedy with David Steinberg, which is a show you've done for two seasons now on TV Land. And I'm on the record of liking that show a lot. In it, you spend a half hour or an hour just sitting in front of the audience with a fellow comic talking. And the part that I want to play is a time that struck me as so unusual. It's a visit with Jon Stewart. And the conversation is so casual that Stewart doesn't even know that you've returned from commercial and resumed the program for real.
Yes.
Your real name is Leibowitz?
What? That is indeed my real last name. Stewart is my middle name.
Stewart. Oh, so you were a Stewart, so that's how you took the last name Stewart. Why?
It's an excellent question. A simple answer. I was distancing myself from my family.
Oh, that makes sense. Yes, I understand that. You see, when I
are we on TV again?
Yeah, we are.
Oh,
yeah.
I didn't know that.
It was a very subtle sort of transition.
I'd assume that if you said we have to take a break for a commercial, at some point you might say, "And now we're back."
So I'd assume that while we were here,
now. Now I find we are back at just at the moment where I'm like, and I'm gay. What? Okay, that's great. All right. Now what do I do? There's a very subtle technique of getting exactly what you need from your guest and then fixing it in post.
It did occur to me to say, we're back, right? But since we just went into dialogue, I thought we could just continue talking.
This is, and people don't realize, this is the improvisational performer in you.
That is correct.
Is he right? Is that the improv performer in you?
What I wanted to do, Dave, was to do a show where it's me interviewing comedians, but it's two comedians talking, so my notion was sort of like jazz musicians, so it's not just... I don't want anyone talking about their craft. I want to show the craft by just being funny about the conversation in your life, and there's an example of it.
Now, one of the things in your book... the Book of David that you mention is that you actually broke to a different level with Johnny Carson on The Tonight Show by getting away from that sort of prepared preparatory material.
I did. You know, what happened, Dave, was on very early on, he asked me to host the show. And actually on my second appearance on The Tonight Show, he said to me, I get really tired doing the show. I think next Monday I'm going to take off. Do you want to host the show? I said, sure. You know, I was, 26 years old thinking that I deserved all of this. I'm so arrogant. And I said, sure. Why not? And in hosting the show, I saw what happens. I have to look at a question. I have to lead the guest in by asking a question that he will answer, and then I had to know what his outline was. I had to know when he was getting out by looking at a note. And I'm on. You remember, you're on camera, so you're sort of sneaking your notes. You have to look at it ahead of time. Mm-hmm. But what it makes for is it didn't allow me to really listen to the other guest real well because you're just letting him talk, and then when he's funny, it's over. You just move on to the next thing. So having learned that as a host, I thought I would love to just free Carson up from having to look at a note at all. So I said, why don't we just, I will give you just subjects. I'll give you sports. If we were in New York at the time, I'd say, we'll talk about the Knicks. At that time, I was single. And we'll talk about dating. And you could go at any order you want. I will have a beginning, middle, and end worked out. If we get to it, it's fine. If we don't get to it, it's fine. And he said to me, David, this is just the worst idea I've ever heard. He said, it just won't work. I said, fine. And then he didn't let me do it that night. But the following 6 weeks, four weeks later, I replaced, a guest dropped out. So I was brought in the last minute. And I said, just let's try it. Here are the areas and all of that. Well, I thought it was going to work. But what I didn't realize about it, Dave, is that the connection with Carson, if I would introduce my material or my ideas, whatever it was, let's say about dating, I'm talking about a date with a girl who dropped her contact lens in my mashed potatoes or something like that. Mm-hmm. He was always funnier about the material that I had than I was, and or as funny. And he would, but he was free to participate whenever he wanted to. So what I realized at the end of that show is, it's not only, it's not just about the lines and how witty you are as a guest. It's about the connection. When you're on television and you connect with Johnny, when he connected with me, that was the palpable feeling that the audience had that was more important than how witty I was, how many lines I had, how funny I was. And I started to feel it even when people would talk to me on the street. Oh, Johnny seems to enjoy you so much, and it's so much fun watching you guys together and all of that. So I just lucked into the right way to present myself.
Was there something during that first time when you weren't doing material, when you were just trading topics, that you got a sense from him that he loved what you were doing and accepted it?
Well, yes, I would get that, just because there's only one way that a comedian gets love real fast in his mind from someone else, and that is laughter. He would just, we would laugh. He would laugh at me, laugh at what I was saying, and I had an advantage over other comedians. I had come from Second City, where I could improvise off of my own material. So it was a little bit looser than most people at the mm-hmm. time. And I think, and yes, and he committed to me right away, and he would commit to me on the air. He would just say, well, that's just great, or laugh, and, you know, put his finger under his eye, and just that laughter made all the difference.
Here's a question about the book. I don't want you to take the wrong way, but
oh, I have a feeling I'm going to, just from the question.
No. It's you talk about your comedic influences as a stand-up comic, being Woody Allen and Lenny Bruce, and then you were lucky enough at one point to have a reviewer actually mention that.
Yes,
those two exactly.
Yeah. Yes,
the part that I hope you don't take an insult or take any umbrage at is mm-hmm. whether in writing the style of the book that you're writing, doing it biblically all the way through, mm-hmm. are you still emulating Woody Allen? Are you trying to?
Well, you couldn't emulate a more brilliant comic mind. So I don't take umbrage at that at all. Yeah, Woody's writing is the best. I love the way he writes. Now, when I got the review, my influences were Woody Allen as a comedian and Lenny Bruce, who I had seen them, and they were spectacular. When I got that review at the bitter end, and they said a cross between Woody Allen and Lenny Bruce, I found it embarrassing, because I had thought I had carved my own niche out at that point.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize I was just copying my idols. So in answer to your question, yes, there, you know, the people you respect, you know, so long as you're not plagiarizing or stealing from them, you have to let that influence be in you. Woody, because of the craftsmanship of lines and self-deprecating style and an elevated kind of comedy. And Lenny Bruce, when I saw him, I was at University of Chicago when I was 21 years old. I had never seen, I came from Canada. I'd never seen a play or a comedian. And a man, Bill Alton, who was running Second City, took me to see him. And what I absorbed from Lenny Bruce, just in looking back, that I didn't even realize was I learned from him that you don't need the entire audience if you're a comedian. In fact, if you're too needy of that entire audience, you're not really going to find your own style. Lenny, in those days in Chicago, he was playing to he was packed always at the Gate of Horn, but he only had a third of the audience with him. And the two thirds of the audience, they were there to sort of scowl or just, you know, he was always described as Lenny Blue Boy Bruce, and mm-hmm. he'd been arrested in Chicago. And I don't know what they were there for, but they had no identification with him at all. And he didn't seem to mind that at all. So that was a really important lesson for me, is don't play to the sort of mass audience. Don't water yourself down. Find your audience the hard way, by finding a third, and then maybe that'll become a little bit bigger and bigger. So those are the two lessons from both of those guys.
And then one more question about you as an author. What was toughest about writing comedy for the page rather than improvising it or writing it for the stage?
At not being able to talk. I mean, what I do is I'm a storyteller. I talk everything. And getting your voice on the page is just almost an impossibility. That was the difficult part of doing this. And, you know, writing in the biblical style, so we wrote the biblical style all the way through. And my friend Joel Engel was really helpful in all of the Bible, St. James stuff, helping me with that all the way through. But I still felt I didn't get my real voice in. And the editor, David Rosenthal, said, you know what you want to do is you want, because the most absurd stories that you read in the book of David in the biblical parts mm-hmm. are mostly true. Very few of them are not true. Just a couple I exaggerated, but they're mostly true. And so David Rosenthal had a wonderful suggestion. Why don't you do footnotes in your own voice? And I thought, oh, that makes sense. So that's what that's where I felt comfortable finally with writing this in this style.
Yeah, I think they're the funniest footnotes I've ever read, but I don't know how many funny footnotes you read. I mean, that's a safe compliment. But I'd like you to read one so that everybody will know what we're talking about here.
Sure.
On page 148 of your book, you have a footnote that
yes.
Is dealing with a time that you were the host of a Friar's Roast of Milton Berle. And because Friar's Roast is such a raw place,
yes.
almost all the jokes, all the comedians came up were making fun not of Milton as the TV superstar, not of Milton as the guy who pushed television forward in its earliest generation, but how would you say what it was that they were focusing on?
Help me here. Well, Milton... we don't know who started this rumor. Most comedians feel Milton himself. Milton is known for the size of his burl, let's say.
All right, okay.
Yeah, so that, you know, most of us believe that that's Milton's notion from his viewpoint looking down. We don't know if it's true or not.
Okay, so basically, this footnote is describing comic after comic coming up and making variations on the joke, and then you get to the poor last guy in line,
yes,
seemingly with nothing left to say.
Yes, I was the host of that evening, the Roastie, it's called, rather pretentiously for some reason. And yes, it's a symphony of these kind of, let's say, burl jokes, using our euphemism. So the final roaster was Dick Shawn. And, you know, I felt almost apologetic as I walked him to the dais because there was no joke left that hadn't been used.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the last guy there. And it's just been a variation of Milton's amplitude, for lack of a better word. And I just didn't know what Dick was going to do. But Dick was a visual comedian. And he... You know, they're verbal comedians and visual comedians. And a visual comedian, he just created pictures all the time. And he just stood up to the mic very confidently. And he said, I actually got to see it. It was at the Friars Club in New York. And Milton was in the steam bath. And I thought he was there with his son. Well, now that's a brilliant use of that's how brilliant Dick Shawn was as a visual comedian. And of course, he just killed. The whole room just went nuts. They said, thank you very much. And the evening was over, and that was it.
Comedian, director, and now author David Steinberg. We'll continue our conversation after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking with David Steinberg, and who has a new book called The Book of David. One of the things you talk about in your book, The Book of David, is what you call the Temple of Second City.
Yes.
And you were either lucky enough or skilled enough or both to get in very early to a group in Chicago when there were incredible talents there.
Yes. Yes.
Nichols, May, Arkin, Klein, Willard. I assume they were all there when you were there for your 6-year stretch.
Well, Nichols and May had already gone to New York, so the second company. Nichols and May didn't stay in Second City. They helped create it, and then they moved on. But this, and Shelley Berman the same way. But this was Alan Arkin and Barbara Harris and people that are known to Second City people, Eugene Trubnik and Andrew Duncan and Bill Alton. They were amazing. Barbara Harris and Alan Arkin in a relationship scene were amazing to see. I was at the University of Chicago with literally no plan in mind. In fact, most of the theme of my book, Dave, is that I had no plan. I never had a plan. And I saw Second City, and I really didn't know what I was going to do. No one would have picked me for being a success at anything at that point. And I saw them, I snuck into Mandel Hall at the University of Chicago, and I saw these guys doing this, and I said, oh my God, I said, I do this. I've been doing this my whole life, what they're doing. And I don't do it as skillfully, and I don't know how I got to figure out how they do it, but it was amazing. And I was on fire at that point, and I wanted to follow them like you follow the circus. And I had a friend of mine at University of Chicago, a lawyer studying law. His name was Gene Kadish, and he was interested in show business. And I never understood why, because he wasn't particularly good at it. He's a great lawyer, but he said, why don't we do an act, you and I? And I said, well, what are we going to do? I said, I don't know. You'll write something, and we'll see. So I wrote an act that was like Second City, like what I had seen. And we played at a place called the Crystal Palace. We got a gig just by fluke. We were opening for a great performer, Oscar Brown Jr., so we had an audience immediately. And we did these little sketches, and some little review somewhere in Old Town in Chicago wrote, Second City should see Steinberg and Kadish. And that night,
Couldn't ask for anything better than that.
It was a dream come true. And Del Close and John Brent and people from that company, Jack Burns, Avery Schreiber were the new company there. They came and they saw us and they hired us and I was away.
Who were you best at on stage with at Second City?
Well, you know, it's really a good question. Bob Klein and Fred Willard were brilliant together. They were brilliant together, and they were brilliant they were great by themselves too. I had my eye more on the audience. Early on, the director suggested that, why don't you do something? The thing about Second City that was so different in the 60s, that's before Saturday Night Live found Second City people. In the 60s, we were like the Rolling Stones in Chicago. It was intelligent humor, humor done from the top of your intelligence, was political. It was just as smart as it could be with the directors there, Patinkin and Paul Sills and Viola Spolin. They were masters at this forum in teaching you how to do it. So it was incredible. So when I think it was Sheldon suggested to me that I use some of my yeshiva theological background, I thought, well, what do you mean? I'm not going to do that. I mean, I escaped that. Mm-hmm. And that night I just thought, well, you know, what? Why don't I just go out there and, I knew the Bible from my background. I was taught Hebrew at an early age and speak it, and had been to Israel and all that at Hebrew University. So I asked for a suggestion for an Old Testament personality. And the suggestion, I think, was Moses. Mm-hmm. And I did a version of that sermon of Moses. And I was doing it 5 years later, almost intact from the first improvisation that I had of it that night.
Comedian, director, and author David Steinberg. We'll continue our conversation in the second half of the show. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air. Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Somerset Maugham's novel Of Human Bondage, in stores and online at bn.com. And from TIAA Craft, putting the values of a .org to work for the financial future of those who serve the greater good. That's powerof.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, music from Guys and Dolls. Saxophonist Harry Allen and singer Eddie Erickson tell us about their new CD, and we'll hear selections from it. And we continue our conversation with comedian David Steinberg. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli. When David Steinberg performed with the Second City Improv Troupe, one of his signature bits was to take on the character of a preacher, ask the audience for suggested biblical topics and characters, and deliver a sermon on the spot. The most memorable example was on the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, a popular CBS variety series. Well, you became not only famous doing sermons, comedy sermons, yeah, but you became infamous.
I did.
Because of the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, which is a project that's so dear to my heart.
Yes.
When you did one sketch on the show and so much negative mail poured in.
Yes.
Later on in the same season, Dick is away for the week. He's off racing. Tommy is in charge. You do another skit that kills. And then, if I can believe all of you people that are telling this history, off the cuff, Tommy just sort of says, hey, you got another sermon in you?
It's exactly how it happened. I mean, well, first of all, let me just tell you about Tommy Smothers. Tommy Smothers, one of these rare individuals who loved talent. He loved the musical talent. He loved comedy talent. So he had seen me on The Tonight Show and asked me to do it. And I did Moses. And as you suggested, that the next week, the most negative mail that CBS, and they claim any network, had ever received up until that point. So he showed me gleefully all this negative mail. And incidentally, what I didn't know is that CBS had told him that you could have Steinberg on as much as you want, but no more sermons. And he knew that. I didn't know that conversation had taken place. And he said, you know, do you want to do another sermon? And I said, sure, because our piece had gone so well that night. And I went out, and I always improvised, even though I had done so many of them by now that they were no longer needed. You could just give me any name, and I had done a version of them somewhere. Mm-hmm. And they suggested Jonah. And in the middle of Jonah, I think I could say it now.
Well, actually, wait a second. I may actually have this to play.
Oh, great.
So this is from the program that got the Smothers Brothers fired. An improv performance by David Steinberg on the subject of Jonah. This is from 1969.
Okay.
That way he got into a ship that was commandeered by 23 Gentiles. A bad move on Jonah's part. And the Gentiles, as they're wont from time to time, threw the Jew overboard. Now here there are two concepts that we must deal with. There is the New Testament concept and the Old Testament concept. The Old Testament scholars say that Jonah was in fact swallowed by a whale. The Gentiles, the New Testament scholars, they say, hold it, Jews. No. Jonah, they literally grabbed the Jews by the Old Testament. They say Jonah could not have been swallowed by a whale, the New Testament scholars say, because whales have tiny gullets and cannot swallow whole prophets. Therefore, they offer their own theory that Jonah was in fact swallowed by a gigantic guppy. And to this day, the New Testament doesn't sell.
Do you have any memories about how that was going over as you were doing it? It sounds like a lot of laughter.
Yeah. You know what? I haven't heard it in so long. See, what happened as a result of that, what we just listened to never got on the air.
Right.
Because CBS yanked the show. Didn't just say, oh, let's just not do Steinberg. Took the Smothers Brothers off the air.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in a way, it was safe for them to take them off the air for a religious piece, which you could see could be offensive to what then we call the silent majority. Never having heard it, you don't know, is it irreverent? Is it fair? You could see where they could use that and no one would question them because it sounds as irreverent as anything you've ever heard. But in truth, the Smothers Brothers were against the war in Vietnam. We all felt then that there were others like us out there. And they tried to, and Tommy tried to sneak in this sort of revolutionary political stuff on the air. It was very, if you listen to it now, you don't, and you compare it to, let's say, Bill Maher, who's remarkable in his courage, as far as I'm concerned, mm-hmm. but you wouldn't really understand what it was about. But then you couldn't get anything on the air because you had to go through standards and practices, the censors, and they sort of combed through everything, but everything we did, we sort of had to fool them to sneak anything on the air. So it seemed to all of us that the White House was after, in retrospect, that the White House was after getting the Smothers Brothers off the air. They had a major influence on the country, the number one show. They didn't want Pete Seeger singing his anti-war songs or Joan Baez or anything like that. And so they could easily go at me, and anyone would say, oh, sure, well, yeah, that is offensive, and like that.
We're talking to David Steinberg, author of The Book of David. One thing I want to talk to you about that isn't in your book, that I'm surprised that it's not, is that you sort of stop when you get to your directing career, and I'm fascinated by your career as a director. The credits include Mad About You and Seinfeld and Friends and Curb Your Enthusiasm. It's Gary Shandling's show, Newhart. Now, you seem to have specialized over the years in directing stand-up comics, especially stand-up comics who do some, if not a lot, of improvisation. It seems like a perfect way to take what you've learned. You say there's no design to your life, but this seems like a pretty good plan.
Well, it was a plan in retrospect, but I don't think it was a plan at the time. But I couldn't have asked for anything better than a show like Curb or all of them. And every one of them was, you know, again, when a stand-up comedian has a show like Seinfeld or Paul Reiser or Ray Romano, they have a co-executive producer who are major writers. Ray Romano's, it's Phil Rosenthal. In Seinfeld, it was Larry David. But and Paul Reiser too work with many executive producers, and the thing about these guys who make it as in sitcoms when they're comedians is it's not they manage to capture something of their aura as a stand-up comedian in their own writing on the show, so you're looking at guys who are also really good writers, and that's how you break through. So Seinfeld was a really good writer, and so was Paul Reiser, and so was Ray Romano, and that's how these shows sort of pop. Now, the odd peculiarity about comedians is, comedians, I keep on mentioning jazz musicians because it's a little bit of the same, comedians like to have other comedians around them. So if I'm a director and I also am a comedian and I say something to Paul Reiser or Helen Hunt and you say exactly the same thing, you Dave, you say that, well, they wouldn't listen to you. Yeah. They'd be nice, but they will hear me because you trust other comedians. And that trust that you need in another comedian, I think, was the reason I just kept on working.
So as a director, you say that the strength of these people is their writing.
Correct.
Evaluate them very quickly as actors in terms of their particular strengths and quirks. Like, how good an actor is Jerry Seinfeld?
Not a great actor, but he's good at being Jerry Seinfeld. Paul Reiser, a great actor. Paul Reiser has major acting chops. Larry David, no acting chops at all. But when he got Curb Your Enthusiasm, which none of us expected to last more than a year, and it's a community of people that now have been working together for quite a while on Curb, he wanted to try improvising, and just improvising the dialogue. And he did the first show, and it didn't work. But so Larry called me in, and we looked at the first show, and it was all improvised, overlapping dialogue. You couldn't understand. It was like bad Cassavetes, and about as funny as Cassavetes. and I said to him, what did you do? I mean, what did you tell the actors? I said, I don't tell the actors anything. I said, what do you mean you don't tell the actors anything? Well, you know, I like it when the actors don't know what I'm going to say, but the reason that I'm improvising is I won't be able to repeat anything. I'm not an actor. So I have to, if you ask me to do something twice, I won't be able to do it. so that, this whole improv community that has grown out of Curb comes from Larry's just wanting to not have to repeat it like actors do, which is their technique. And then I said, you know, what you have to do when you're talking to another actor is you have to give them the beats of the scene. They have to know the beginning and the middle and the end. And he said, "Okay, well, you know, all right, well, let's do that." But you know, I like it when they laugh. I like it when they laugh at what I'm saying. I said, "Well, you know, I don't like it when they laugh at what you're saying because that doesn't quite work." And we sort of argued our way through this and worked it out. And now I have to say, just in case someone asked Larry to tune in, he is a great actor now.
Well, it's a great program at any rate, and he gets a lot of credit for that, as do you. Yes. Well, David Steinberg, thank you very, very much for being on Fresh Air.
Thank you, Dave. I enjoyed this.
David Steinberg. His new memoir is called The Book of David, and a new season of HBO's Curb Your Enthusiasm, on which he serves as one of the directors, returns next month. Coming up, saxophonist Harry Allen and jazz singer and guitarist Eddie Erickson, featured on a new jazz recording of Guys and Dolls. This is Fresh Air. There's a new jazz recording featuring songs from the classic Broadway musical Guys and Dolls. It's by the Harry Allen Joe Cohn Quartet. Allen is a tenor saxophonist, Cohn plays guitar, and Eddie Erickson sings.
When you see a guy reach for stars in the sky, you can bet that he's doing it for some doll. When you spot a John waiting out in the rain, chances are he's insane, as only a John can be for a Jane. When you meet a Jane.
That's Eddie Erickson singing. The other featured vocalist on the CD is Rebecca Kilgore, who may be a familiar name and voice to regular Fresh Air listeners. Kilgore has performed on our show many times. She performs regularly with Eddie Erickson as part of the group Bed. Terry spoke with Eddie Erickson and saxophonist Harry Allen about their new collaboration. Both of them first heard Frank Lesser's music from Guys and Dolls when they saw the movie version, which starred Frank Sinatra.
Lesser wrote a song for Sinatra in the movie that wasn't in the show, and the song is called Adelaide, and you do that song on your recording of Guys and Dolls. Would you tell us why you decided to choose that? Because for a lot of people, that would be an unpopular choice because it's not in the original show.
Well, one of the interesting things about Guys and Dolls, the show had some different songs that were left out of the movie, and the movie had some songs that were specially written. And it made sense to me that Adelaide was written specifically for Sinatra because I don't think any of the other of the cast of either the show or the movie would have been able to sing it. It's not that easy of a song, which is why we have Eddie do it, because he's such a great singer.
Eddie, what's hard about the song?
Well, just the intervals, you know. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. You know, sometimes if you're a little flat or a little sharp, which I am often, it jumps around quite a bit. And when you first hear it, like I say, in the movie or in the movie when Sinatra was doing it, he makes it sound so easy. And then you look at the music, and there are little half steps instead of whole steps that you think, oh, that's a whole step. Well, no, actually, it's just a half step. It's a little tricky to sing. Just the intervals are tricky. Once you get to do it, then once you get it down, it's easier, obviously. But that was one of my favorite songs of the movie.
This is a song that I think doesn't work unless it swings, which is one of the reasons why it makes sense that Lesser wrote it for Sinatra. And Eddie Erickson, you sound great on it. And
oh,
so,
you're so kind.
Why don't and Harry Allen, so do you. So why don't we hear Adelaide from the new Harry Allen Joe Cohn Quartet recording of Guys and Dolls, and featuring my guest Eddie Erickson.
Unaccustomed as I am to getting married, I am taking this occasion here to say that me and Adelaide are finally naming the day. Though she knows deep in her heart
I'm a phony and I'm a fake. She wants 5 children to start. 5's a difficult point to make. But Adelaide, Adelaide, ever-loving Adelaide is taking a chance on me. Taking a chance, I'll be respectable and nice. Give up the cards and dice and go for shoes and rice. So gentlemen, deal me out. Do not try to feel me out. I got no more evenings free. Since Adelaide, Adelaide, ever-loving Adelaide's taking a chance. Talk about your long shot. Take a chance on me.
Singer Eddie Erickson from the new album that they did of music from Guys and Dolls. Now, Harry Allen, you're a tenor saxophonist who has obviously been inspired by name some of the people who inspired you.
Well, I would say that my two biggest influences are Ben Webster and Stan Getz. Originally, I was very influenced by Scott Hamilton coming up.
Who was also influenced by Ben Webster.
Yeah. And then there, from there, it goes to a lot of other people, Coen Hawkins, Lester Young, mm-hmm. Zoot Sims, Al Cohn.
So how did you get introduced to jazz? Because I think fewer and fewer people hear jazz when they're growing up now.
My sister was a year ahead of me in school, and there was a time when she had to go to school an hour before I did. And my father would sit at home with me during that hour and play recordings, Benny Goodman recordings and Duke Ellington recordings and Count Basie. So I listened to an hour of great music every morning, and I'm sure that's where I got my love of it from.
Let's hear an instrumental track from your Guys and Dolls CD. And this is All Know, beautiful ballad. Do you want to say a few words about it before we hear it?
Well, it's just a stunningly pretty song. I started playing this long before I decided to do a Guys and Dolls CD. So we've been playing this for quite a while with the quartet. And I think it's just one of the most beautiful songs I know.
Okay, this is the Harry Allen, Joe Cohn Quartet from their new CD, Guys and Dolls. Thank you.
That's the Harry Allen Joe Cone Quartet performing I'll Know from their new Guys and Dolls Jazz CD. More with Harry Allen and Eddie Erickson after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with saxophonist Harry Allen and featured vocalist Eddie Erickson. They collaborated on Guys and Dolls, a new jazz CD by the Harry Allen Joe Cone Quartet, also featuring vocalist Rebecca Kilgore. Eddie Erickson told Terry he started playing music long before he began singing.
I started on ukulele when I was 7, and then I looked at a banjo when I was 13 and actually got one for Christmas because I thought it was a pretty instrument. Hanging in the music store in the window. And I started on tenor banjo, and at 19 I started on plectrum banjo, which is a four-string tune, like more like a five-string than a tenor banjo. And then I got interested in guitar, listening to George Van Epps and Howard Roberts, and later on, of course, Howard Alden, who I became good friends with when he was just about 15 years old. And he was playing only banjo at that time. Yeah, so definitely I started playing way before I took my singing seriously.
Well, I really love your singing voice. What made you start singing?
Years ago, I started out right here on the Monterey Peninsula at a place called The Warehouse, and I was 20 years old. I was 1 year younger than I should have been because they served liquor. And it was kind of a free-for-all. We had a gal who would come up and sing. Everything from Janis Joplin songs to Billie Holiday. And she would make me weep. Her renditions and her feeling and her energy. And that made me stop and think, wow, this is neat. Not only the song's great and just, you know, notes and chords, but wow, the lyrics are so beautiful. And if you sing them in a special way, they can really bring you to tears. But I would continue doing kind of the Hammond Baloney singing, you know, sing along. Everybody sing along, and we'd play these songs at, you know, 300 miles an hour. And then we'd rip it after that. It wasn't till I think I really started taking singing seriously when I met Rebecca Kilgore.
When you say Hammond Baloney, I should mention that you used to perform at Disneyland and Disney World.
Yeah, well, there's the birth of Hammond Baloney.
and you led the Riverboat Rascals on the Disney Empress Lily showboat.
Yes.
What kind of material did you do?
Well, it was the same kind of stuff that we did at the Warehouse. We'd have continuous entertainment with the trio, the Riverboat Rascals. Would play, and then we'd bring up a comedian slash guitarist, singer, and he would take over, and then it would just kind of rotate throughout the night like that. And it was just a big laugh fest and a lot of fun. And occasionally, I would sing a serious song.
Harry, can you talk about playing behind a singer, which is not something that you typically do on your records?
I love playing behind great singers. I was very fortunate to have worked with Maxine Sullivan and Rosemary Clooney and Tony Bennett, and I love backing up great singers. With a great singer, they leave space, and it's the horn player's job to fill in that space in an appropriate way, just make little comments here and there. Very often a bad singer will not leave any space, and you sit there twiddling your thumbs.
Would I've Never Been in Love Before be a good example of what you're talking about?
Yes, absolutely.
Why don't we close with that?
All right.
Eddie Erickson, Harry Allen, thank you both so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry.
Thank you so much. Thank you. It's an honor.
Harry Allen and Eddie Erickson speaking with Terry Gross. Erickson is a guest vocalist on the new jazz recording of Music from Guys and Dolls featuring the Harry Allen Joe Cohn Quartet. This track features Erickson, as well as the album's other guest singer, Rebecca Kilgore.
I've never been in love before. Now all at once it's you. It's you forevermore. I've never been in love before. I thought my heart was safe. I thought I knew the score. But this is wine that's all too strange and strong. I'm full of foolish song, and out my song must pour. So please forgive this helpless haze I'm in. I've really never been in love before.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. I'm David Bianculli. Terry Gross returns tomorrow.
Support for NPR comes from CNN. Tomorrow night, Christiane Amanpour reports on God's Warriors. Three nights, three religions, starting tomorrow night at 9 on CNN. From the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. And from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Sailing from Byzantium, How a Lost Empire Shaped the World, an account of the Byzantine Empire by Colin Wells. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the songwriting team of Marilyn and Alan Bergman. Their songs include Nice and Easy, The Way We Were, What Are You Doing the Rest of Your Life, and You Must Believe in Spring. Join us for the next Fresh Air.